come to believe that he was American, that what was good for him was good for the country, that the expansion of his own influence was critical to its survival. Ferris could rationalize anything based on his all-encompassing belief that he, and no one else, must be in charge of every aspect of American life. The idea that he might be wrong, or that opposing views might have some validity, were so alien to him that he was sincerely baffled when anyone brought up the possibility. In his mind, there was no sacrifice that shouldn't be made in order to protect his privileged status, as long as those sacrifices were made by others. "I've given copies of the emails between myself and Akhtar Durrani to my lawyers and new campaign consultants. The emails you threatened me with. None of them see any problem. A foreign official lodged a complaint against the CIA and I began an investigation. Now that I know you lied to me, that your man Rickman was in fact a traitor, it appears that my decision to look into the matter was well-founded."
"I assume this is going somewhere, Senator?"
He smiled. "I can call a press conference this afternoon, admit my relationship with Durrani, and then come after you with guns blazing. But since your ship's already sinking, I don't think you'll be able to take much of that. And it sounded to me like the president's skirt is no longer available for you to hide behind. Would you also admit to your relationship with Ahmed Taj?" He was clearly prepared for the question. "Why wouldn't I have one? He's a witness to CIA wrongdoing, including what I suspect was your assassination of his external wing commander. In fact, if this comes to a committee hearing, I might call him to testify." Ferris wasn't particularly intelligent, but he was smart enough to hire good people. She was convinced that much of his financing was coming from Pakistan, and believed that she would soon be able to prove it. The revelation that his campaign was being fueled by an unstable Muslim nuclear power, even if his attorneys managed to make it technically legal, would do irreparable damage to his ambitions. For now, though, she would remain silent on the subject. "Mitch Rapp threatened not only my life, but the life of one of my people. You're drowning in this Rickman thing. The CIA is being exposed for what it is. I don't think it's time for you to start throwing stones." Her phone vibrated in her pocket, and she reached for it. Only communications from Mitch, Mike Nash, and Marcus Dumond were enabled while she was at the White House.
"Excuse me a moment."
The text on her screen was written in Marcus Dumond's brief but emphatic style. "Got it. Server in Russia. On my way to meet Mitch and Scott at airport." The message was followed by an emoji of his caricature, wearing sunglasses and flanked by two thumbs up.
"It's been nice talking to you, Senator, but I'm afraid there's something I need to attend to."
When she reached for the door handle, Ferris grabbed her wrist.
"You don't want me as an enemy, Irene. When I become president, the CIA will come under political control, and Mitch Rapp will spend the rest of his life trying to stay out of prison. The question is what happens to you. You can fight me and end up like him, or you can be a good little girl and walk away with a pension and a high-paying private sector job. If you're smart, and I know you are, I'd suggest you give some thought to which future you see for yourself."
Chapter 49. Outside of Vologda, Russia. The snow was light, but the wind was strong enough to rattle the windows of the scattered buildings. It was 2 a.m., and the small industrial park was all but abandoned. What little illumination existed was provided by a few icy security lights glowing over doors locked down for the night. Kabir Gadai approached on foot, taking a circuitous route that kept him in complete darkness. His team leader was crouched at the edge of the only parking lot in the area still containing cars. The windows of the building on the far side were about half-lit, with hazy human figures visible moving inside.
"How many people?" Gadai asked as he slipped in behind his man.
"We don't know, sir."
Normally he would have carefully researched the company and sent an advance team to determine its rhythms before embarking on an operation like this. Once again, though, Taj had made those kinds of precautions impossible. His desperation to acquire Rickman's files continued to grow, turning incaution into outright volatility.
Any call for premeditation would have done nothing but throw the man into a rage.
Maxim and Raisa Durov?
All evidence points to them both being inside. The house is empty and their car is in the lot. There's no way to be entirely certain, though.
The Durovs owned the small internet service provider that hosted the email address connected to the Rickman files. Based on what little Gadai had been able to find out, the former hackers had a very exclusive clientele of oligarchs and organized criminals who valued the privacy the couple could provide. It was a shame there would be no opportunity to look deeper into their organization. Undoubtedly, they had access to a great deal of information that could benefit Pakistan, Islam, and him personally.
Do we have schematics of the building?
No, sir.
Gadai let out a frustrated breath. Their entry into Russia had been less than careful, and now they were embarking on a completely improvised operation. He was beginning to wonder if these files were a gift from Allah or a punishment from the devil.
Your people all know what the Durovs look like?
We were provided photographs.
Then you have my authorization to begin.
The former soldier spoke into a microphone on his wrist, and a moment later Gadai saw movement west of the building. A man in a long gray coat walked across the parking lot and knocked on the glass door leading to the reception area. A young woman sitting behind a curved desk stood and walked toward the front of the building. She appeared to be unarmed, and her relaxed gait suggested that she was unconcerned by the late-night visitor. Either this was a common occurrence in an industry without set hours, or she was confident that the company was well protected by its client list. She unlocked the door and leaned out, saying something in Russian. Gadai's man spoke the language fluently, but didn't respond. Having confirmed that this wasn't Raisa Durov, he grabbed the woman's long hair in one hand and chin in the other. A violent twist created a soft crunch that carried across the lot. Gadai began to move as soon as it reached him. More men, his team numbered 6 in all, appeared from hidden positions and headed for the building. Gadai entered and went immediately to the desk while the woman's body was dragged behind it. As he'd hoped, there was a bank of monitors streaming security camera video from throughout the building. With no floor plan, it was impossible to connect the images with specific locations. But at least he would be able to get an idea of what they were dealing with.
10 people in all, he said to the men gathering around him. 6 are asleep, either in cots or on the floor. The remaining 4 are working behind terminals. Maxim and Raisa are separated from the others in what appears to be their office. I think we can assume it's on the top floor. We'll use the stairs and clear the 4 floors, 2 at a time.
Gadai led, splitting his force. One went through a metal door at the back of the lobby, while he ushered the men staying with him into the stairwell. They ascended quickly, coming out on the 2nd floor and clearing the bathrooms before continuing silently down the hallway. The first few rooms were empty, but the last contained a woman and 2 men who looked to be in their late teens or early 20s. All were asleep on cots, and he motioned to his men, assigning targets. They each fired a single shot from their silenced pistols.
2nd floor clear, he said into the microphone attached to his wrist. 3 contacts down, continuing to the 4th floor.
The response over his earpiece was immediate.
1st floor clear, 1 contact down, continuing to the 3rd floor.
They entered the top floor with no resistance. All doors in the corridor were open, but only one had a light on. Gadai moved toward it as his men checked for people asleep in the other rooms. He stopped next to the entrance to the lit office. 2 of his 3 men accompanied him, while another stood in a doorway down the hall and signaled with 1 finger. The flash and the muffled pop of his Beretta 92F were loud enough to cause the clack of keyboards in the office to go silent. Gadai moved through the door with his weapon in front of him. Raisa Durov let out a strangled chirp of a scream, and her husband's eyes widened as he raised his hands.
"Stay where you are," Gadai said as his men fanned out behind him.
"What?" Maxim stammered. "What do you want?"
"Information."
"Do you know who really owns this company?" Raisa said incredulously. "You can't do this."
"Shut up, woman,"
Gadai said, approaching and pressing his silencer to the side of her head. She cringed in fear, and he locked eyes with her husband.
"Do you want her to die?"
"No, please, don't hurt her."
Gadai handed him a piece of paper.
"This email address, who does it belong to?"
"How would I know? People don't have to give me their real names or locations when they set up an address. It could be anyone."
It was an absurd lie. His ISP wasn't Google. It was private, expensive, and highly selective. Maxim would have access to everything that went through his server.
"Third floor clear," came the voice over his earpiece. "Three contacts down."
Gadai turned his gaze to the young woman for a moment. She was in her late 20s, with a thin body and vaguely Asian features. Her dark hair had a streak of blue that was nearly identical to the color of the sweater stretched tightly over her breasts. Another whore like the one who had been sleeping with the men below.
"Do what you want with her,"
Gadai said, taking a step back and adjusting his aim to Maxim's head. His men grabbed the woman and threw her to the floor. One used a switchblade to cut off her sweater, leaving a thin red line where the blade had contacted her skin.
"No!" Maxim shouted. "Stop!"
He tried to get out of his chair, but Gadai slammed a boot into his chest. One of his men had a hand clamped over the woman's mouth and her arms pinned behind her. She fought wildly as the other cut through her pants.
"Stop!"
Maxim said, the panic rising in his voice. "I'll tell you what you want to know!"
Too late.
The woman's bra and jeans were in tatters on the floor now, leaving her wearing nothing but a pair of bright red panties. Gadai was enjoying watching the terror in her eyes.
"Please, whatever you want to know, I'll tell you," Maxim begged. "If you hurt her, though, I'll lock the whole system down. I swear you won't get anything."
It was an empty but expected threat. A hierarchy had been established, and Maxim was well aware of where he and his wife existed on it.
"Since we seem to understand one another," Gadai said, "my men will stop."
The disappointment was clear on their faces, but it made sense to pull back before the woman was completely naked before them. It provided a line that her husband would not want crossed.
"Who does that email address belong to?" Gadai repeated.
"I have to use my computer to find out."
Gadai nodded, and the man turned slowly in his chair, reluctant to take his eyes off the men holding his wife.
"I have people monitoring every access point into this industrial park," Gadai said, pressing his gun to the back of Maxim's neck. "If you send out a warning and we see someone approach, I'll make you watch my men cut your wife apart."
"I'm not going to warn anyone. We handle thousands of email addresses. You can't expect me to remember them all."
In fact, Gadai didn't. He had always known that this information would need to be pulled off the server and that there was danger in giving a man like Maxim access to a keyboard. Unfortunately, it was a danger he could do nothing to mitigate. Gadai watched the Russian type, not understanding what he was seeing, but doing everything possible to give the impression that he did.
"Where are the others?" Maxim said as he worked. "Are my people all right?"
"Of course, and they'll remain that way as long as you give me what I want."
He scrolled down a list of email addresses, finally clicking on one near the bottom of the screen. A name and nothing else came up. Pavel Kadzin.
"Where can I find him?"
"I don't know, I—"
Gadai spun the chair so that Maxim was once again facing his wife and nodded. She was still being held from behind, now with one of his men fondling her breasts. The knife came out again, and a moment later her panties were being thrown across the room.
"Wait!"
Gadai held up a hand.
"Why? Why should I stop my men when you're telling me nothing but lies?"
"I know where Pavel lives. I can't guarantee he's there right now, though. I—"
"Where?"
"I have to use my computer again. If I turn around, your men won't hurt her. I have your word."
"I want only the information I came for, Maxim. The fact that I don't have it is the only thing keeping me here."
The young computer expert went back to his keyboard, pulling up a Russian mapping site and zeroing in on a remote region to the north.
"He's here."
There was no city or town marked, only what looked like an empty expanse of wilderness.
"You're trying to tell me this man lives in the forest?"
Maxim switched from map view to satellite view, and a small outpost revealed itself. One street with what looked like four buildings on either side.
"What is this?"
"It's a—"
he searched for the English word.
"Commune. About 30 people live there."
"Criminals," Gadai said. "Staying out of the reach of authorities."
"Yes."
"Part of Russia's organized crime network?"
"No. Mostly spammers and con artists. They traffic in a few stolen goods, but it's mostly internet scams."
"What's the closest access point?"
You could fly into Uchta.
That's still more than 100 kilometers away. How would I get to their location?
Maxim ran a finger along a barely visible line leading from the commune.
It's hard to see, but this is a road. It's packed with snow this time of year, but they maintain it well enough to get a snowcat through. It's how they bring in supplies.
Gadai nodded. You've done well.
Then you're going to leave? You're going to let us go?
The Pakistani smiled as Maxim turned back toward his wife. The knife that had been used to disrobe her was now drawn across her neck. Maxim screamed as the blood sprayed across the room, splattering his legs and bare feet. Gadai grabbed him by the hair, forcing his head down and firing a single round into the back of it. Gadai started for the door as his men cast off the still thrashing woman.
Burn everything, and tell our pilots to lay in a flight plan to Uchta.
Chapter 50. Northwestern Russia. The plane's left side dipped violently, stretching the seatbelt across Mitrap's lap and slamming his head into the window. He awoke and squinted through the glass, but there wasn't much to see. A wing with a disconcerting number of rivets missing, heavy snow streaking past the lights, and the darkness beyond. Another violent gust struck, but this time the plane rose, shoving him down in his seat with impressive force. He closed his eyes again. The weather was the pilot's problem. And while the Russians couldn't do much right, they did blizzards better than anyone. A long, terrified scream became audible, but he ignored it and let himself drift again. It was the first time in days that he'd been able to get fully asleep. There would be no more posthumous chess games with Joe Rickman. No more talk. Finally, he and his team had an opportunity to take action. Marcus Dumond, the source of the scream, believed that if their competition really was Pakistan, enough files had been released for the ISI to have traced the location of the hacker they were on their way to find. In fact, S-Wing operatives might have already been there, obtained Rickman's encryption key, and gone. If that was the case, the trip to Russia would be a complete waste of time, but still better than standing around Langley waiting for another gloating video to hit Kennedy's inbox. Rapp felt a hand close on his shoulder, followed by the voice of Scott Coleman shouting over the roar of the wind and straining engines.
We're going in.
Crashing or landing?
I'm not sure. The good news is that the pilot says we'll be fine. The bad news is that it looks like he's been crying.
Rapp just nodded and went back to sleep.
Mitch, rise and shine. We made it.
Rapp opened his eyes and stretched, looking around at the carnage on the small plane. Most of the overhead bins had given way during landing, leaving some of their gear strewn across empty seats and the rest on the floor. Charlie Wicker and Bruno McGraw were gathering everything up while Marcus Dumont clutched his laptop, looking queasy. He was standing near the cockpit as their sweat-soaked pilot threw his shoulder repeatedly against the door. It finally came free with a blast of wind nearly strong enough to knock him over. That didn't deter Dumont, though. He leapt through the opening and into the snow. The cold was both immediate and lung-searing. Rapp pulled on a white parka designed to camouflage him against the winter landscape and headed for the front. The stairs were down now, and he descended, pulling Dumont out of a snowbank and dusting him off.
I shouldn't be here, Mitch. I'm a tech guy. This is ops. It's fucking freezing, and we're 100 miles from the middle of nowhere. We could get trapped out here. How would anybody help us? No one even knows we're here, do they? I told my girlfriend I was—
Marcus, shut up and try to relax.
Rapp moved away, studying what little he could see. Beyond the circle of illumination generated by the plane, there was nothing but blackness. Inside the circle, there was nothing but snow. If anyone was out there, it'd have an advantage, but not much of one. Even a shooter with state-of-the-art optics would have to be within 10 yards to even pick out a target, let alone hit it. His men started throwing duffels out the door just as the muffled hum of a motor separated itself from the storm. A set of lights appeared a few moments later, mounted to a bright red tracked vehicle. Rapp unzipped his jacket for better access to his weapon as it came to a stop. The logo was Cyrillic, but below was an English translation. Shuryov Hunting and Snowmobile Tours. They'd gotten lucky when Nash found the outfitter. Their camp was only about 30 miles from where the Rickman files were being released by a Russian crook named Pavel Kadzin, Their cover was as a last-minute booking by a corporate team-building group. There wasn't time to create an elaborate legend, so Rapp just had to hope that Nash hadn't missed anything. After Istanbul, it wasn't a great time for him to get recognized in Russia. A figure in a North Face Himalayan suit jumped out of the vehicle and started running toward them. It wasn't until the person got within a few feet that Rapp could make out the face inside the hood. The woman's skin was a bit more windburned than the pictures he'd seen, but still unlined, with dark eyes and a long, straight nose. She was only 29, and as far as the CIA could tell, had spent nearly all of those years in this wilderness. Her father had started the company after leaving the Soviet Army, and had run it until his death 2 years ago.
"Mr. Kramer," she said, extending a gloved hand, "I'm Irina Shulyov. I'm so sorry I wasn't here to meet you. We only just got word from the pilot that you are coming in. We never expected him to fly in this weather. Are you and your people all right?"
"Fine," Rapp said, regretting not putting Scott Coleman front and center to deal with her. He did easygoing charm a lot more convincingly. There was a little turbulence there at the end, but not too bad. Her expression was incredulous, and he realized that he'd overplayed his attempt to be disarming. Shulyov's clientele were probably accustomed to safer and more luxurious travel methods. In contrast, he and his men had spent half their lives stuffed into the back of C-130s. At least the aircraft they'd come in on that day had windows and wasn't a prime target for every radical old enough to lift a rocket launcher. "We heard there's a wolf pack in the area," he said, changing the subject. "Do you think we'll have a chance to get a few photos?" She looked past him at Coleman, who was still tossing duffels to McGraw and Wicker on the ground. Dumond had carved out a rough seat in the snow and was planted in it, trying to calm down.
"That's a lot of gear."
"We weren't sure what to bring, so I guess you could say we brought everything."
"This is no problem," she said, still looking a bit confused. "Let me help you carry your bags to the truck."
She started around Rapp, but he blocked her path and thumbed toward Dumond. "We can handle it. My friend over there got a little airsick on the way in, though. Maybe you could take him to your rig. A little sympathy wouldn't hurt either."
"Oh, I'm so sorry. Of course."
Shulyov rushed to his side and helped him up. Keeping an arm locked in his, she chatted encouragingly as they made their way across the snowpack.
"Cute,"
Charlie Wicker said, coming up next to Rapp.
"Your kind of woman."
Wicker was debatably one of the top five operatives in the world, and undisputably one of the top three snipers. He'd grown up in a small town in Wyoming hunting with his brothers. When he was 12, he'd gotten separated from them in a storm not unlike this one. After 3 days, everyone assumed he was dead and that they wouldn't find him until the snow melted in the spring. On day 4, he'd emerged from the wilderness without a scratch, dragging an antelope he'd shot. Rapp originally thought it was just a legend, but when Wicker left the SEALs to join Coleman's company, he'd pulled the man's file. In it was a copy of the news story, complete with a photo of a skinny kid with a big grin and a rifle towering over his back. Since then, not much had changed.
"Grab the gear and let's get out of here," Rapp said. "I want to be on the trail in an hour."
Chapter 51 Irina Shulyov seemed to be piloting the vehicle entirely by memory. The powerful headlights illuminated nothing but a disorienting tunnel of snowflakes that looked like they were being shot from a cannon. Powerful windshield wipers swept manically across the glass, but appeared to have no purpose other than to create an electric whine that competed with the howl of the wind. According to the agency's weather forecasters, the storm would continue through the night with temperatures dipping into the single digits. Windchill would be in the -20 range. Not exactly Rapp's favorite operating conditions. A few years back, he'd acknowledged this gap in his skill set and joined a couple of SAS friends on a 2-month-long training session in Antarctica. To this day, he remembered it as 60 of the most miserable days of his life, a blur of frozen appendages, unruly sled dogs, and hypothermia. Rapp had managed to be the first to drag himself across the finish line of a 100-mile self-supported race across the tundra. He could still hear the instructor's comment,
"Well, you can't ski for shit, but you've sure got a big motor."
Even fresher in his mind was the frostbitten chunk of his right thumb that turned black and fell off. It eventually grew back, but he still didn't have full sensation.
"I don't want you and your friends to worry,"
Irena Shulyov shouted over the ambient noise.
"We have a high-pressure system coming in tomorrow, blue skies and no wind. It will be a perfect day for touring and taking photos."
That jibed with what he'd been told, but unless things went very wrong, he and his team would be long gone before visibility got much over a mile.
"Sounds great.
How's your friend doing?"
Rapp glanced back at Dumond, sandwiched between Coleman and Wicker. It was a bit hard to tell in the dim light, but he seemed a little less green than he had back at the plane.
"Fine. He's really looking forward to taking in the sights."
Rapp couldn't see her face, but the giant hood she was still wearing moved forward and back in what he assumed was a nod.
"Is there anything in particular you and your friends would like to do? I see you brought skis. Avalanche danger will likely be considerable, but there are some lower-angle slopes that will remain stable. We're expecting at least 2 meters out of this storm."
She spoke a little too fast, jumbling her passable English. It was possible that the nervousness was just a holdover from having her clients coming in on such a dangerous flight, but he suspected it was more than that. It would be pretty clear to anyone with even a room-temperature IQ that they weren't middle managers from Procter & Gamble. So now Irina Shulyov found herself alone in the wilderness with a group of men who would probably be familiar to her from her father's time in the Russian military.
"What kind of work do you do?"
she asked, the silence obviously magnifying her discomfort.
"Product development."
"What kind of products?"
"How long have you lived here?"
Rapp said, changing the subject.
"All my life. I went to college in St. Petersburg, but hated the city. The people, the cars, the buildings blocking the sky. I can't imagine being anywhere else."
Rapp was about to ask another question to keep the conversation focused on her, but she pointed through the windshield.
"We're here. That's the main building. My guides have prepared food, and we have drinks available there if you like. If you're tired, though, I can take you directly to your cabins."
"Are all of your guides in the main building?"
"Yes."
"How many do you have working for you?"
Rapp knew he was being less than subtle, but there wasn't time to screw around.
"Only two," she said. "My permanent men. In the high season, I have as many as 6.
"Why don't we swing in for a drink, then?" Rapp said. "I'd like to meet them."
"Of course."
Irina relaxed a bit, and it was no mystery why. According to Nash's intel, her two guides were brothers, both in their mid-30s and both born and bred in the area. One was former army, and the other had spent 8 years roughnecking on oil rigs. They weren't to be underestimated. She pulled up in front of a log building, and Rapp twisted around to face the rear seats before getting out.
"Irina's going to introduce us to our guides."
Coleman gave a barely perceptible nod. The hope was that this would go smoothly, but the only thing that really mattered was that it went fast. The clock was ticking. Snow blasted the exposed skin on Rapp's face, turning to ice on his beard as he passed through a rough-hewn door. Inside, it was probably only about 40 degrees, but that temperature felt like the tropics by comparison.
"The main building is a bit rustic," Irina apologized. "But don't worry, the cabins were completely updated only a year ago."
The modest heat was generated by a single greasy wood stove in the corner. The room was approximately 30 feet square, with a restroom at the back. The door to it was open, and Rapp confirmed that it was unoccupied. Both guides were standing next to a low table arranged with liquor and food. They looked as formidable as expected. Dumond went straight toward them, giving each a polite smile before going for the vodka. His actions were more the product of his near-death experience on the plane than a preconceived plan, but they worked nicely to divert the men's attention. Coleman used the opportunity to check out a shortwave radio near the building's only window. Wicker and McGraw took up positions on either side of the door.
"Alexei, Stepan," Irina said, "I'd like to introduce you to Mitch Kramer."
Rapp shook their hands and exchanged a few pleasantries before pointing to a map on the wall. The CIA had some broad-stroked stuff and a few high-resolution photos, but this looked quite a bit more detailed.
"So where are we?"
Irina tapped her finger near the center while her men took drink orders from the rest of his team.
"Right here.
Tomorrow we'll go out through this shallow canyon to the north. The plateau it leads to is where the wolf pack has been seen. With the weather clearing, I think we have a good chance of getting close enough for photos.
Rapp ignored the tourist route and followed the elevation markings toward a dotted line that dead-ended about 30 miles to the east.
What's that? A road?
Of sorts, Irena said. It leads to a small commune. It's kept relatively clear in order to get supplies in and out.
What kind of commune? Are they artists? My wife loves pottery.
No, they keep to themselves. We won't be going anywhere near there.
A cold blast of air hit them, and she turned to wave a cautionary hand at Wicker and McGraw as they pulled the door open.
It's dangerous outside in this kind of weather. If you'd like to go to your cabin, I can send one of my people with you.
No worries, Wicker said. We're just going to stand under the light and have a smoke.
This isn't America. You can't smoke in here.
Wicker smiled, and they disappeared outside. Irena motioned for one of her men to follow, but Rapp moved to intercept.
They'll be fine. How about you make me a drink? Vodka.
He looked at Irena, and she shook her head, motioning again toward the door. Based on her expression, she wasn't sure what was happening, and this was her way of finding out. Probably inevitable, but not the way Rapp had wanted it to go down. He blocked Stepan's path again, this time shoving him backward. Surprise flashed across the Russian's face, and then he reached out to grab the front of Rapp's jacket. He was a bear of a man, typical in this part of the world, 6'1", 240, with thick forearms covered in dark hair and tattoos. Someone best dealt with quickly. Rapp grabbed Stepan's thumb and bent it back before sweeping the man's right leg just below the knee. He executed the maneuver about half speed, enough to put the Russian on the ground, but not enough to do any permanent damage. The air rushed out of Stepan's lungs, but he looked more surprised than injured. More problematic was the fact that his equally burly brother had come around the makeshift bar and was in full charge. He made it only a few steps before noticing Coleman tracking him with a silenced Glock. That was enough to bring him to a halt, but it was an open question whether he was smart enough to stay that way.
Irena, Rapp said, you own this company, right?
She was completely frozen, eyes locked on the gun. Finally, she managed to answer.
Yes.
Then you're in command, and these men are your responsibility. You understand you can't win, right? All that can happen is that you and your people get hurt. She said something in Russian, and Alexei helped his brother to his feet. Then both retreated to the bar.
We don't have anything worth stealing,
she said, trying to decipher what was happening.
What do you want from us?
I want you to go to bed, Rapp said. Tomorrow morning I want you to sleep in. Your fees have been paid, and we'll be wiring another $50,000 to cover damages.
Damages?
Right on cue, McGraw came back through the door.
They use walkie-talkies for local communication, and the shortwave is connected to an antenna out back. We've cut the wires, and Wick's on the roof dismantling their satellite dish.
What about the snowmobiles?
All well-maintained and gassed up. We've loaded the gear on the 5 newest ones and disabled the others. Keys are in them.
He glanced at his watch.
Wick said he'd be ready to go in 4.5 minutes.
Rapp loved working with Coleman's team. No complaints, no hesitation, no detail too small or timeline too tight. He turned back to Irena. Do we have a deal?
Chapter 52. The Russian-built snowcat was shut down, leaving an icy world illuminated only by a distant glow. Travel up the makeshift road had taken almost 9 hours, and had involved digging a path through 3 drifts too dense for the vehicle's front shovel. Kabir Gadai stared through the windshield, letting his eyes adjust to the gloom. Spindrift swirled from the towering banks on either side, but with less violence than it had only an hour ago. The snowflakes were still thick and heavy, but now floating straight down at a predictable rate. With the engine off and the storm subsiding, the breathing of the 5 ISI operatives packed in behind him now dominated. Based on what he knew from the odometer and intermittent GPS signal, the source of the dim light was Pavel Kadzin's village,
perhaps a half-kilometer to the east. As had become customary, there was no time to collect detailed intelligence or recon the area. They were in a race against America's Central Intelligence Agency, and once again, Gadai would have to endure risks that would normally be unacceptable. According to his FSB informants, the village was inhabited by approximately 10 families, some of which included children. Focused on hacking and internet scams, they weren't involved in any activity that could create territorial disputes, and they paid significant protection money to both organized crime and the police. Combined with the remote setting, this suggested, but by no means guaranteed, that they would have light security. "I'll go in using the road," he said as his men began piling out of the vehicle. It was the most straightforward of the three attack plans they devised. Unfortunately, it was also the most dangerous. With visibility so limited, though, the risks were outweighed by the benefits. Every moment of delay increased the potential for a confrontation with the Americans. Gadai started the snowcat and propelled it forward. His men would follow at a distance that allowed them to remain in darkness. At first he thought the entrance to the village was completely unguarded, but then he spotted a man running toward him. He was wearing mismatched down pants and jacket, both in garish colors that made him stand out against the white background. The rifle over his shoulder hung up as he clawed at it, finally coming free and allowing him to aim the weapon in Gadai's general direction. It was a pathetic display that confirmed his suspicions about security. No doubt the men of the village took turns on watch with no regard to ability or training. Gadai slid the driver's side window down and shouted a greeting in Russian as the man cautiously approached. Satisfied that he posed little threat, Gadai turned his attention to the small enclave beyond his windshield. The photos he'd seen appeared to be accurate. The village formed a rough U-shape, with four buildings on each side of a snow-packed street and one at the end. All were two stories, constructed primarily of local timber and metal sheeting. A single snowcat and various snowmobiles were visible, but showed little sign of use. None could be dug out quickly enough to be used as escape vehicles, and fleeing into the wilderness on foot would be suicide. When the man got to within a few meters, he called out to Gadai. The Pakistani smiled in an attempt to put the man at ease, but also in reaction to his own good luck. He possessed only a single blurry photo of Pavel Kadzin, and had assumed that he would have to question the guard out of fear that it could be him. The man's pure-blood Asian features made that unnecessary. Gadai lifted the silenced pistol from his lap, aiming it through the open window and squeezing the trigger. The round hit the man directly between the eyes, and he crumpled to the snow without so much as a whimper. Gadai's team appeared a moment later, running past the snowcat and fanning out in a well-coordinated pattern. He jumped down to the snow and sprinted toward the first building on the left as his men began accessing the others. The door was unlocked, and he went inside, entering an open room with threadbare sofas and a kitchen stacked with dirty dishes. There was a set of stairs to the left, and he began to ascend, dragging a hand against the wall as a guide in the darkness. He heard a muffled scream from outside and picked up his pace, concerned that it might wake the house's occupants. His instincts were right. When he slipped into a room on the upper floor, he found a man desperately searching an old chest of drawers for a weapon. He spun when Gadai stepped on a loose floorboard and instinctively threw an arm in front of his face. He was wearing only a pair of briefs, but his long hair provided a convenient grip point that Gadai used to drag him down the stairs and out into the snow. He began to babble in Russian, but Gadai ignored him, scanning the upper windows of the buildings for any threat. There was nothing, though. His men had control of the situation and were marching people out of their homes at gunpoint. Men, women, children, and even infants appeared, some fully dressed and others naked or in bedclothes. His team lined them up on their knees, standing behind them with weapons at the ready. Some were shouting angrily, others pleading. The children wailed, already shivering as their skin reddened in the frigid temperatures. "Who here speaks English?" Gadai said. They all looked at each other, but no one answered. Normally, he would have just stood there and let them freeze, but he had neither the time nor patience for that. Despite his heavy clothing, he himself was beginning to suffer from the bitter climate.
I'll ask only one more time. Who here speaks English?
What do you want?
Gadai turned toward the man who had spoken. He was fully dressed, but his daughter, probably no older than 6, was wearing only a long T-shirt. He had wrapped his arms around her for warmth and was trying to quiet her sobbing.
I want Pavel Kadzin. Are you him?
No. Pavel isn't here. He left weeks ago.
For a career criminal, he was an almost laughably bad liar. Gadai raised his pistol and aimed it at the girl. The man tried to put himself between her and the weapon, but the cold made him a fraction too slow. Chapter 53 Rapp's team had abandoned their snowmobiles about a mile back and were now making slow progress through the wilderness on skis. Gaps had formed in the clouds, creating intermittent splashes of stars. Not much light, but with the snow reflecting it, there was enough to proceed without night vision equipment. Since this frozen landscape was fundamentally indistinguishable from Charlie Wicker's backyard, Rapp had put him on point. McGraw was breaking his own trail 35 feet left, and Coleman was keeping roughly the same interval to Rapp's right. Just ahead, following unsteadily in Wick's tracks, was a very unhappy Marcus Dumond. Despite the young hacker being dressed head to toe in white, his outline was clearly visible. When it started to waver, Rapp swore under his breath and accelerated to a near run. Once again, he was too late. Dumond tipped right, overcompensated, and ended up buried in the deep snow. When Rapp pulled alongside, Dumond was thrashing like a drowning man, digging himself in deeper in an attempt to keep his nose and mouth clear.
"Marcus, stop moving," Rapp said in a harsh whisper. "This stuff's like quicksand."
"What am I doing here?"
he whined, sounding like he was on the verge of breaking into tears.
"I'm freezing and I'm exhausted. Just leave me. Just leave me here to die."
There had been no choice but to bring Dumont along. Coleman was probably the best computer guy they had on the ops side, and he still hadn't fully figured out texting.
"Spare me the melodrama, Marcus. Now grab my pole."
Dumont threw out a mitten-clad hand, and after a few tries, Rapp managed to get him back on his skis.
"Slow and steady, kid, okay? If you feel like you're starting to lose your balance again, stop before it's too late to get it back, understand?"
"Mitch, I—"
"Do you understand?"
"Yes."
He gave Dumont a full minute's lead before starting out again. To his right, he could see Coleman pacing him. Wick and McGraw were out of visual range, but they would have stopped too in order to keep the intervals he'd stipulated. Miraculously, the next 10 minutes passed without any more problems. The wind had died down, and the snow absorbed sound with startling efficiency. Beyond the hiss of his skis, the only thing audible was the occasional dull whoop of snow dropping from overloaded tree branches. Rapp came to an abrupt halt when the silence was broken by the faint echo of a gunshot.
"Marcus, stop," he said into his throat mic. "Crouch down on your skis and don't move."
There was no follow-up shot, and all his men checked in safe. After staying motionless for almost a minute, it seemed clear that whoever had fired wasn't aiming at them.
"Wick, can you get a bearing?"
"Hard to say with the acoustics, but I'm pretty sure it came from the village. It's dead ahead, less than 500 yards.
Rapp accelerated, stopping next to Dumond to pull him back into a standing position.
"Stay. Just stand here and don't do anything."
"What, alone? Are you crazy?"
"You'll be fine."
What if something happens to you? What if you don't come back?"
"That's not going to happen, Marcus."
"But what if it does?"
Patience wasn't Rapp's finest trait, and what little he had was starting to fail him.
"Then you're probably going to die."
He took off, staying in Wicker's tracks and leaving a speechless Dumond to himself. Coleman was out of sight now, having headed southeast while McGraw went north. After a hard 4-minute effort, Rapp saw Wicker's track disappear into a dense stand of snow-encapsulated trees. He released his bindings and covered his skis before half-crawling, half-swimming into a depression beneath trees. He found Wicker lying partially buried with an eye to his rifle scope. The long silencer on the end of his barrel was covered in a silicone sleeve to prevent heat shimmer from interfering with the optics. They were at the western edge of the village as planned. Its inhabitants, 25 or 30 in all, were in the middle of the street in various stages of undress. Most were on their knees, being guarded by 3 armed men in white jumpsuits identical to the ones his team wore. The one exception was a child lying in the snow with half her head missing. Of more immediate concern was the armed man running north, dragging along with him a man wearing a T-shirt and boxer shorts. Pavel Kazdin.
"What have we got?"
Rapp whispered.
"Pakistanis," Wicker said. "You can always tell by the mustaches."
4 tangos visible from our position," Rapp said into his throat mic. 3 in the square, and 1 running west with our potential target. Bruno, give me a sit-rep."
"I have eyes on your runners.
They're headed for the building at the end of the road, and they're going to make it before I can get an angle. No other movement. Windows look clear, but it seems unlikely that they don't have anyone up there. Scott, I'm at the entrance to the village. 1 dead local and 1 armed tango. Judging by the tracks coming out of a snowcat, I make it 6 men total." That left 1 tango unaccounted for, and it wasn't hard to guess where he was. To his left, Rapp saw the 2 men disappear through a door in the building at the far edge of the village. It wouldn't take Kazin long to access those files. Most likely, a matter of minutes. "Scott, do you have a shot at the man guarding the entrance?"
100%.
"Take it, and move into a position to cover the east-facing windows.
Give me 1.5 minutes, 2 at the most.
Bruno, how long to get into position to cover the west-facing windows?"
"The same.
Do it." Rapp pointed to the men guarding the civilians in the street.
"Can you take the 2 on the right, Wick?"
"No problem."
Rapp slid the rifle off his back and lined up on the head of the man to the left. He was scanning the area for anything unusual, no longer having to pay much attention to his prisoners. The intense cold was doing his job for him. A number of the children had slipped into unconsciousness, and their parents looked like they were on the verge of doing the same. Another 15 minutes, and they'd all be dead. Coleman's voice crackled over his earpiece. "Tango's down, and I'm in position." A few seconds passed before McGraw came on.
"I'm ready."
"Okay, then. On 3. Rapp counted them off and then squeezed the rifle's trigger. His target's head exploded along with the head of the man next to him. Rapp immediately dropped the rifle and vaulted the low snowbank. He made it to the street just as the 3rd Pakistani was swinging his rifle into position. Rapp ignored the threat and sprinted up the road. A moment later, the puff of Wicker's silenced rifle sounded, and he knew without looking back that there were no tangos left alive behind him. Rapp retrieved his Glock from beneath his jacket and made it about 100 yards before a cloud of snow and ice kicked up to his left. As anticipated, the Pakistani assault team had put a man in the upper floor of one of the buildings. Fortunately, the sniper had underestimated Rapp's speed and failed to lead him enough. Wicker had turned Rapp on to a pair of Dynafit ski boots that didn't weigh much more than his running shoes. They allowed him to hold a faster pace on the hard-packed snow than many college sprinters could on a track. The shooter wouldn't make the same mistake twice, though. The sound of shattering glass reached him as he continued to run along the front of the buildings. Coleman's voice came over his earpiece a moment later.
"Sniper's down."
Rapp slid on his hip, ending up behind a pillar, bowing visibly under the weight of an overhang piled with snow. He crawled to the door the 2 men had disappeared through and found it unlocked. Before entering, he glanced back into the street. It was as if nothing had happened. The locals were still slowly freezing to death, watched over by 3 armed men in white jumpsuits. The only difference was that now those men were his. Rapp would have liked to give the order to take at least the children to safety, but it was impossible. The man holding Pavel Kazin would be unlikely to miss something that obvious. If he looked out the window, and he would, Rapp couldn't afford for him to see anything but exactly what he expected to see. Chapter 54 Gadai shoved his prisoner through the door and watched him fall to the floor. Pavel Kazin curled into a fetal position on the warm surface, pulling his hands to his bare chest in an attempt to warm them. His feet appeared to be completely numb, making it unlikely that he would try to escape.
"Your computers," Gadai said,
scanning the room and finding only telephone headsets set up on desks piled with paper files.
"Where are they?"
"Up," was all Kazin could get out. His teeth were chattering audibly, and his shivering had become so violent that he appeared to be in the throes of convulsions. Gadai forced the man to stand. He couldn't walk on his own, making it necessary for the Pakistani to support much of his weight as they ascended a set of stairs. Normally, he would have made his prisoner go first as a shield. In this case, though, Gadai would have to rely on his skill and the bulletproof vest beneath his parka. Until the Russian decrypted Rickman's files, he had to be protected at all costs. Despite the darkness, entering the second floor with any stealth was made impossible by the whimpering man. Gadai dropped him on the landing and slapped the light switch before stepping out with his Beretta held in front of him. The upper story was a single open space, similar to the one below, but lined with computer equipment. He dragged Kazin to the nearest terminal and propped him in a chair. "You've been decrypting and releasing a set of files sent to you by a law firm in Rome. Do you know the files I'm speaking of?" Kazin managed only a weak nod, and Gadai pressed his gun to the side of the man's head.
"Speak!"
"Yes," Kazin said, his voice shaking with panic and cold. "I know them. I want the encryption key." Kazin hesitated. "My people, you have to release them. Let them leave here and I'll give you whatever you want." Gadai had been through this scenario already, with Maxim Durov, and his patience had run out. He reached for a letter opener next to the computer, but then hesitated. While it would be a pleasure to ram it into the man's leg and start making threats, Kazin was already compromised by hypothermia. If he lost consciousness, it would accomplish nothing but cause further delays. He pulled Kazin from his chair and forced him to the window at the far end of the room.
"Look!"
The Russian tried to turn away, but Gadai shoved his face into the icy glass. The people of the village were just barely visible through the falling snow. A few were still on their knees, but most had collapsed at the feet of the men keeping watch over them.
"They're dying, Pavel. Not an hour from now, not in 10 minutes. They're dying now. And you can stop it. Only you."
"I..." Gadai twisted the man's head around and stared directly into his eyes.
"I don't care about you. I don't care about your people. Give me what I want and you can go to them. You can get them to shelter and care for them, but do it now, Pavel, because it may already be too late for the children."
Kazin pulled away, and this time Gadai allowed it. He watched the Russian stagger back to the computer and peck awkwardly at the keyboard with dead hands. It took an excruciating 2 minutes before the screen suddenly filled with a solid block of nonsensical characters.
"That's it," Kazin said. "That's the encryption key."
Gadai shoved him to the floor and sat, peeling off his jacket as the sweat broke across his forehead. He pulled a thumb drive from a pocket in his vest and inserted it into the computer's USB slot. When he tried to open one of the Rickman files it contained, the screen prompted him for a password. He pasted Kazin's key into the window and held his breath. A moment later, the individual documents appeared on the screen. Gadai opened one, skimming a dossier relating to a CIA mole inside the Chinese Defense Ministry. A second file opened with similar ease and contained a detailed account of the illegal rendition of a French citizen living in Yemen. His mouth went dry, and he leaned back for a moment, staring at the screen. It was done. With the proper cunning and the unwitting help of Carl Ferris, there was no limit to the damage Taj could do to the Americans.
"I've given it to you," Kazin said. "Have your men take my people inside."
Gadai ignored him and opened a browser navigating to Gmail on the village's satellite link. He typed in the address Taj had given him and pasted the key into it. After pressing the send button, he leaned back in his chair again. Kazin was struggling to get to his feet, pleading in broken English, but Gadai was consumed by the words on the screen. "Your message has been sent. Praise be to God." Chapter 55.
"Mitch, I'm getting really cold and freaked out,"
Marcus Dumont's voice over his earpiece. Rapp stayed in the shadows beneath the overhang
unbuckling his boots and sliding along the building's wall until he reached the door. A gentle twist of the icy knob suggested it was open, but he didn't immediately enter. The storm had kicked up again, and the gusts were coming with a predictable rhythm. He waited a couple of cycles to solidify the timing in his mind, and then used the roar to cover his entry.
"Mitch?"
Dumont prompted again, the fear in his voice notching higher.
"Are you still out there? Are you okay?"
Coleman responded, "Stay off the comm, Marcus. Everything's fine. Just a few more minutes." Rapp crouched and swept his Glock across the room. No movement. Light was flooding down a staircase to his left, and he could hear muffled voices at the top. There was no other way up, so he padded toward it in damp socks. The ancient wood looked like it was barely holding together, forcing him to test each step for sound before fully committing his weight. He paused on the landing, listening for evidence that his approach had been noticed. Nothing. Rapp swung around the wall and into the room with a single fluid motion. Pavel Kazin was trying unsuccessfully to stand, fear and pain etched deeply into his face. The Pakistani was carelessly sitting with his back to the entrance, staring intently at a computer screen in front of him. Kazin spotted him, and Rapp put a finger to his lips. Unfortunately, the Russian had been pushed well beyond the point where he could comprehend an instruction that subtle. He reached out with a shaking hand, "Help me!" The seated man had made an amateur mistake by putting himself in that position, but the speed of his reaction suggested it was an aberration. He leapt to his feet, simultaneously spinning and kicking the wheelchair backward. Rapp was forced to dodge right, but didn't lose his line on the head of the Pakistani, drawing a pistol from a holster strapped over his bulletproof vest. Rapp's finger tightened on the trigger, but at the last moment, he lowered his aim and fired three rapid shots into the man's sternum. When he jerked backward, Rapp charged, knocking him to the floor and pinning the Beretta beneath his foot. The man's eyes and mouth were wide open, but he wasn't making a sound. The rounds Rapp was using hit like a Mack truck. His sternum would be broken, most likely along with a few ribs, painful as hell, but probably not fatal. On the off chance he was unable to get in a breath and suffocated, at least his face was intact for an ID. Rapp reached down and relieved him of his weapon, noting the burning hatred in his expression, before rolling him over and looping a set of flex cuffs over his wrists. "I'm clear in here," Rapp said into his throat mic. "Get those people inside."
"Roger that," Coleman responded. "Can I send Wick for Marcus?"
"Yeah, bring him here." A hand closed around Rapp's ankle, and he turned to see Pavel Kazin looking up at him.
"Thank you."
In acknowledgement of his gratitude, Rapp brought his silencer to within an inch of the Russian's forehead.
"Good people are dead because of you, you son of a bitch."
Kazin tried to pull back, but Rapp followed with his weapon.
"Please,"
he whimpered.
"What did he want?"
The encryption key to some files.
"From a law firm in Rome?"
"Yes."
"Did you give it to him?"
"He was letting my friends freeze to—"
Rapp hit him across the cheek with his silencer.
"Did you give it to him?"
"Yes, yes, I gave it to him. I had no choice."
The door opened on the ground floor, and Rapp heard footsteps on the stairs. A moment later, Marcus Dumont appeared. His hair was dusted with snow, and he was shaking a bit, but otherwise he didn't look much worse for the wear. Spotting the computer, he went directly for it, kneeling in front of the keyboard and ripping off his mittens.
"Kazin says he gave up the encryption key," Rapp said.
"Yeah, I see it here, and there's a thumb drive. Looks like Rickman's files are on it."
"How many?"
Rapp said, leaning over the younger man's shoulder.
203.
Rapp let out a long breath. The number was higher even than the worst-case scenario he and Kennedy had come up with.
"Let's see if it works,"
Dumont said. He chose a file at random and was prompted for a password. A moment later, Rapp was reading a detailed account of a series of assassinations that had taken place in the UAE without the local government's knowledge. He himself had pulled the trigger on two of them, and as near as he could tell, all the information was accurate.
"Did he send it anywhere?"
"Sorry, Mitch. The key went out a couple of minutes ago, via email."
"Can you intercept it?"
"No way. It's gone."
Rapp swore under his breath.
"Where?"
"A Gmail account. There's no way to know who it belongs to. I doubt even Google does."
There was a quiet chime from the computer, and Dumont leaned into the screen.
Hold on. We've got a response.
What's it say?
Key received and fully functional. Well done. Destroy everything.
Rapp stepped back and stared out the window at the storm. 203 files. Ops, agents, informants, and God knew what else. Endless scenarios were churning through his mind, each one more catastrophic than the last.
Do you want me to reply?
Dumont said.
Just say, understood.
Dumont typed the word while Rapp went to the man on the floor and rolled him onto his back. He was breathing, but in shallow gulps that barely provided enough oxygen to keep him conscious.
Who did you send it to?
The Pakistani actually managed a strangled laugh.
The CIA is done, he gasped. We have your entire network.
It wasn't bravado, Rapp knew. The Rickman files would contain enough fodder for years of grandstanding hearings by the self-serving political hacks back home. They would portray the agency as being completely out of control, and now, with its network compromised, completely useless.
Marcus, can you get me a secure video link to Irene?
Yeah.
Do it.
Rapp knelt next to the man on the floor.
I'm going to ask you one more time. Who did you send that email to?
He tried to spit on Rapp, but didn't have the strength, and ended up just drooling down his cheek.
Link's up, Mitch.
Irene, can you hear me?
Barely,
came the crackling response over the computer speakers.
What's your situation?
Rapp grabbed the man by the bulletproof vest and dragged him toward the webcam above the monitor. The pain from his damaged chest stopped his breathing again, leaving him silently opening and closing his mouth as he struggled not to asphyxiate.
Can you see? Rapp said. Get a screenshot and run his face through our computers.
Kennedy's image was badly pixelated by the weather's effect on the sat link, but he could see her shake her head.
I don't have to, Mitch. That's Kabir Gadai, Ahmed Taj's personal assistant.
Rapp let the man go, and he collapsed to the floor next to Pavel Kazin.
Do you have the encryption key? Kennedy asked.
Yeah, but I'm not the only one. Gadai emailed it out before I could get to him.
There was a long pause before she responded.
Then you're saying Taj has access to the files?
All 203 of them.
That many?
She raised her hands to her temples, rubbing them in slow circles as the image broke up.
Marcus, send her the files and the encryption key.
At least now they wouldn't have to guess. She could start damage control and try to get ahead of the ISI. Not that it was likely to do much good. A little like putting a band-aid on a severed limb.
We've won, Gadai said weakly. The ISI will dominate the world intelligence community for the next half century. And it was all made possible by your work and your dollars.
Rapp wanted nothing more than to leap into the air and land with both feet on the man's broken sternum. But he held back.
God rewards his servants, Gadai continued, and he punishes his enemies.
Rapp stepped back and looked down at the man, finding him willing, maybe even anxious, to lock eyes. Everyone had a weakness. For some, it was intolerance to pain. Others had a faith that was less unshakable than they imagined. Gadai's was suddenly clear. Arrogance. Despite the agony speaking must have caused, he continued to gloat, to demonstrate his superiority. Deep down, he wanted to talk. He wanted the Americans around him to know how thoroughly and easily they'd been beaten.
Don't get too far ahead of yourself, Rapp said. We have access to the files now, and Taj doesn't know it. We'll pull in the people we need to, and the others will watch. We'll tie the ISI up in so many knots you won't trust your own mothers.
You're a fool, Gadai gasped. When I don't come back, Taj will assume you have the information. We've outsmarted you at every turn, and he will continue to do so.
Rapp glanced up at Kennedy, and she gave a slight nod, indicating that she'd heard. Gadai had just unwittingly confirmed that Taj was behind this.
the CIA's network will be destroyed, and after tomorrow night, there will be nothing you can do about it, Gadai continued. Run, both of you, before your own politicians set out to destroy you.
Rapp smiled and pressed his foot down on Gadai's damaged chest. Not hard, but enough to silence the men. Tomorrow night. What happens tomorrow night? The surprise on the Pakistani's face was easy to read. He realized he'd said too much. The door downstairs opened again, followed by the sound of footsteps running up the stairs. Dumond retreated against the wall as Rapp aimed his pistol toward the landing. He lowered it when Scott Coleman appeared. "Where do we stand?" Rapp asked. "All the people are inside. Wick and Bruno are working on them. The easiest way out is going to be the snowcat these guys came in on. We can bring in a plane that can better handle the weather and rendezvous with it in Ufta." Rapp nodded and pointed to Gadai. "Take him." The Pakistani couldn't walk, and he let out a gurgling cry when Coleman lifted him into a fireman's carry. Rapp pointed to Kazin, and Dumond took the hint, helping the man to his feet and following Coleman out. Rapp waited until he was alone before he turned back to the image of Irene Kennedy. "Tomorrow night is President Chutani's reception for the Secretary of State, isn't it?" She nodded. "Sunny's already arrived in Islamabad with a congressional delegation led by Carl Ferris." "But why kill her? Or a bunch of congressmen? What good would that do? As far as I'm concerned, he'd be doing America a favor if he gets rid of Ferris."
"I don't think he's after our people, Mitch."
"Then what?"
She stared intently out from the screen. "If President Chutani were killed at that function, it wouldn't be hard for Taj to convince Pakistan that we're responsible. It's already one of the most anti-American places on Earth." Rapp had to admit that there was a certain twisted logic to it. Coups were the national pastime in Pakistan, and the timing was perfect. Taj could run the CIA ragged with Rickman's files while he took control of the country and its nuclear arsenal.
"So you think we should warn Chutani?" Rapp said.
Kennedy remained silent. Her expressions were always hard to read, but the poor image quality made it impossible.
"What?" Rapp said.
"In the context of that region, Chutani is a reasonable man. But I don't think either of us has any illusions about him. He's a violent, power-hungry dictator who allies himself with us because it's in his best interest. If he gets Taj, then it's likely he also gets the files. I'm not sure I want to spend the next 20 years being blackmailed by him."
"Agreed."
"How fast can you get to Islamabad?"
"Figure 8 or so hours to get to Ukhta, and then flight time."
"Do it, and extract as much as you can from Gadai en route. I'll try to determine our next step from here."
Chapter 56 Islamabad, Pakistan. It was after midnight, and Ahmed Taj was still hunched over his desk. Behind him, large windows looked out on the well-lit campus of ISI headquarters. The traffic beyond the gate was light, as it always was this time of the morning, and armed guards patrolled in the same pattern they always did. The familiarity of it was little more than an illusion, though. Everything had changed. Everything. The goal he'd constructed his life around was less than 24 hours from being achieved, and Taj knew he should be attending to the myriad last-minute details. It was impossible, though. He couldn't tear himself away. The ISI director clicked on another of Rickman's files and scanned through its contents. This one had no taunting video attached, only reproductions of handwritten CIA reports from Ukraine. It seemed that a man high up in the Russian separatist movement had been lining his Swiss bank account with American dollars. Only when his eyes could no longer focus did Taj finally slide his chair back and turn away from the screen. There were still well over 100 files he hadn't yet examined. What secrets did they contain? How devastating would their impact be? Allah had provided so much more than his faithful servant could have imagined. Tomorrow, Saad Chutani would die. His last breath would mark Taj's inevitable rise to rule Pakistan and eventually the Middle East.
These files would not only accelerate his plans, but expand them in ways he never could have imagined.
Taj stood and began pacing across his dimly lit office. The scale of what he would accomplish was just beginning to settle its weight on him. The brilliant Joe Rickman had been planning this attack for years. He'd put together files not only on the Middle East, but on China, Russia, and countless U.S. allies. There was damning intelligence on American politicians, descriptions of unsanctioned assassinations, and detailed accounts of unlawful domestic operations carried out by CIA operatives. Taj would use this information to create a worldwide outcry for the dismantling of America's spy network, and Carl Ferris would be the perfect tool to lead that effort. Taj now had much more than just money to offer the man. He had classified information on many of Ferris's political opponents. The combination of the two would almost certainly be enough to put him in the White House. With Ferris leading America, and Taj pulling his strings, the country would quickly go from the most powerful in the world to completely dysfunctional.